And this is the plug-in turn-on session. We're going to be talking with Brian Bellendorf. He's going to talk about comparing and sort of talking about the differences and the commonalities between open source communities and the electronic dance community. And then Cliff Skolnick is going to talk about freenetworks.org, which is a project he's been working on. And I'll briefly delve into a little bit of just some thoughts and ideas for a project I have. And then we'll just talk as a group discussion. All right. So first we'll talk with Brian.
Okay.
Brian will talk with us.
Okay. Hopefully people can hear me. So I wanted to talk a little bit about a parallel set of communities that shares a lot in common, I think at least, with the underground dance community. And I want to do it, hopefully not in a too long-winded way, but I wanted to talk about a period of time from 1992 to about 1995, 96. And what I was doing, and you know, not to make this about me or anything like that, but I want to give you like a perspective on where my head was or whatever. Okay, so I'll stop apologizing. So in 1992, SFRAVE started in like spring of that year, and the people who had met online were starting to think about throwing parties for themselves, right? And like 2 months after we got started, we threw a small party up in the Oakland Hills, like a Saturday afternoon or Sunday afternoon, with a small sound system. The Hard Kisses played. That was kind of fun. There are a few people here who were at that party, I know. And then we started thinking about a real serious party and doing one at night, right? That would actually be a real event. And we decided to do it around August, I think it was. And you know, I basically had no experience throwing a party other than like a small house party at my house once or something like that when I was in high school. So I sent a message out to the list going, okay, if we want to throw a party, help. You know, how are we going to do this? We started working it out, and on the list said, well, we need a space, and so a lot of people went out and tried to find spaces, and you know, we eventually decided like an outdoor beach location was cool. So Rocky Mullen, who I hadn't heard of at the time, but most of us here know, was a UCSC student, and he said, hey, there's this great beach called Bonnie Dune, we should have it there. We just said, what night should we have it on? And somebody said, well, let's do it on Thursday nights so that we don't piss any promoters off, right? So we did it on like a Thursday night at Bonnie Dune Beach. And most importantly, people started volunteering to DJ, people started to volunteer a sound system. And so we didn't really have a budget for any of this stuff, although you know, like we did rent a projector or something like that. In fact, I think I put it on Bob Jesse's credit card, actually, if I recall correctly. You know, we went out and had fun, and it was basically this loose group of 20 or 30 people who, you know, completely organized over email, right? Had just this like big long text document that was like everyone's responsibilities or whatever, but it was all volunteer, and it was all a sense that everyone was bringing a small little piece of the puzzle, and we had this great thing, and it was called Connection. Was the name of the party. So 1992, you know, was kind of the first year SFRAVES got started. And meanwhile, you know, I was focusing so much on the list and on that party and other things that I just kind of started to, you know, ignore school. I was going to UC Berkeley at the time and decided I needed to take a semester off. So spring of 93, I started working at the like a computer lab at the business school at Berkeley, and I had tons of spare time because basically my only responsibility was like to reboot the printer when it would go down or something like that. So in addition to geeking out over SFRAVE's mail and chatting on VRAVE and things like that, I started to, you know, explore the idea of putting together like music, pulling together the archives of the list, pulling together images of flyers and things like that, and putting them on an FTP site that everyone could download them from to kind of learn what these kind of cool things called parties were, especially as these other rave mailing lists started getting started around the United States. And that led to a Gopher site. Anyone remember Gopher? It was kind of a precursor to the web. So I set up this Gopher server that happened to coincidentally talk this protocol, this brand new protocol called HTTP, right? And then I started learning more about this and found this program called Mosaic, you know, that was like version 0.1 or something like that, and started getting really into this idea of like graphical web pages. And this being 1993, it was still very academic. There wasn't Mac Mosaic or PC Mosaic. You know, fortunately, I was around some Unix boxes and could play with it. And not only that, I started to get interested in how that protocol was being defined. defined, how that technology was being defined. It wasn't some big company sitting up on a hill saying, you know, we're releasing a product that is this and all you minions can use it. It was a group of technologists, you know, from universities, from corporations, from wherever, who were sitting on a mailing list, you know, coincidentally, and talking about what the protocol should do and trying to figure out how it should work, and here and there writing software to prove whether their ideas about how HTTP should work actually made sense. And as I got into this, I started learning about, you know, this is not, was not an anomaly. This was the way that the internet was written, you know, or the internet protocols were defined ever since the 1970s. It was smart guys and girls getting together on a list and talking about what protocols needed to do, right? And then writing some software, writing ideas, writing documents. And it was incredible. There was this whole consensus-driven decision-making process within this body called the Internet Engineering Task Force, or the IETF. And their motto actually was rough consensus and running code, right? And you didn't have to be, you know, a PhD or you know, any sort of like training to get on. I was this dumb 19-year-old kid who had no formal background in, I mean, I'd had computers around, but definitely wasn't a hacker and still don't consider myself a programmer, really. You know, I could step onto the list and I could watch these really smart guys start to talk with each other about how to build this, and I could throw in like the occasional comment about something that I thought was interesting or relevant. And sometimes I'd get, you know, blasted because it was kind of dumb, but other times it was like, okay, it actually contributed to something. So that was 1993, right? Found this kind of parallel that I thought was really cool. And around that time, you know, still very not interested in school, but actually went back. But also started working at Wired Magazine. And Wired was setting up, you know, some of the first, you know, it was one of the first non-academic websites out there. And started to see if they could do a real publishing thing, and called that Hotwire, right? And in the course of pulling this together, you know, a lot of the academic software that was out there around HTTP, things like there was this web server called the NCSA web server. And it was, I think the guy who wrote it, Rob McCool, you know, his previous programming assignments were all like small little video games and things like that. So it was really kind of hacked together. But it was the first one that could actually sustain any reasonable amount of load. So I was using it, I was, you know, fixing it here and there because there were, like, you know, things that I needed to add to it for Hotwired's sake. And then on this mailing list, the HTTP working group mailing list, there were other people who were using the NCSA server as well. And so we started sharing patches with each other. I also, on the side, started working with a group of people, including Cliff here, to start a company called Organic Online, which built some of the first websites that were advertisers in Wired, so there was kind of the connection there. But we needed things there that the web servers that were out there didn't support yet, like the idea that you could have one server but have with one physical box but have many different websites attached to it. Actually, Cliff wrote the code for that. It's called virtual hosting. And, you know, again, this was additions and modifications that we were making to this academic web server. Now, around, I guess it was middle of 94, end of 94, maybe fall, it was clear that NCSA, which was the same group that had put out Mosaic, that was the same group that was doing a lot of kind of this researchy kinds of things, they had lost all of their developers to Netscape, which had just started at the time, and they were hiring everybody they knew to build commercial servers, right? And so there was a group of us, you know, whether it was Wired and Organic, or it was the Internet Movie Database, which just started, or the MIT website, all of us who were saying, hey, you know, what are we going to do if NCSA is not going to take our patches, is what these fixes were called, and issue a new version of the server, then we're kind of screwed, and we don't want to go pay $5,000 per server, you know, to Netscape to run a commercial thing. Partly because we were cheap bastards, but partly because we enjoyed the flexibility of having the source code to be able to change the behavior of the server. And so a group of us basically identified each other on this mailing list and said, well, why don't we combine all of our patches together, because they're starting to get kind of like overlapping and complex and stuff, and release a version of that server on our own. And we looked at the copyright that was on the code, and the copyright basically said this code is essentially public domain, do whatever you want with it, just give NCSA credit for it. And we said, okay, we could live with that, and we like that theory. We like that kind of philosophy. So why don't we continue that? We decided the name Apache was a good name for a server made out of patches, right? And at the and it was January of 95, I think, that we officially started a mailing list, you know, again, a recurring pattern there, called New HTTPD. I think that was even before we had called it Apache. In fact, that mailing list was first hosted on Hyperial, right? So over that list, we started sharing these things, coordinating. Someone stepped up to be the release owner. Somebody else stepped up to maintain the list of bugs that were outstanding. We set up what's called a CVS tree, which allowed us to check code in and out and do version control, all that kind of stuff. And over time, actually fairly quickly, within maybe a year, it became the most predominant web server on the planet. Like 50, 60% of the websites that were out there started using it. And it was partly because it was fairly high performance and had a lot of features and stuff. In fact, it would not only keep up with the commercial servers that were out there, it would usually debut new features first, right? And a lot of that was because the technologists who were on the working group for the HTTP protocols, 1.0, 1.1, et cetera, they would use Apache as their test bed to show that it actually worked. So we got somewhat a degree of notoriety. I think it's because we were particularly well-timed more than anything else. No, they were all internet gods, right? But it was fun. I mean, it was very much a right place, right time. In fact, things like SFRAVES, if it hadn't been started by me, I think Mike Wertheim would have started it the next day or something like that. So, So 1996, we started getting a lot of attention. And what was great to see was that the decision-making process that we would make around Apache and how it got developed was very similar to how we would throw parties, right? Consensus-driven kind of discussions. And it helped that you had something that was software, so you could immediately resolve, or more or less immediately resolve an argument by coding it up and seeing whether somebody's ideas actually worked or not. But there is that same sense of serendipity, that same sense of transparency, right? Everybody's cards are on the table. It's all about, you know, expression and things like that. And there is even a capacity for artistic expression. Like when Dean got it, right, did his famous analysis where he went through Apache and figured out how to get it so that it could serve up web hits in 23 system calls or something like that, right? It was godlike. I mean, it was, you know, the rest of the list was like bowing down in front of him because it was great. And it was like going to see a good DJ perform, you know, just like the skill and the artistry that was involved in something like that. So, I don't know, I guess I kind of went in like 20 different dimensions here, but what this has grown into, there's now a whole Apache Software Foundation, it's a 501c3 nonprofit, and we scaled the organization by saying, okay, this is a team that worked well when there was a half dozen to a dozen core people and maybe a couple, you know, dozen people on the edges of that feeding into it, but let's replicate that. And so under the ASF, there's now about a dozen different top-level projects and code bases within that. It's all very, it's not corporate so much as organized, I guess. But we have the structure now, and we also made it a nonprofit so it could protect the developers and be kind of a legal shield in case anybody decided to come up after us. And if you notice, none of this is about necessarily getting something for nothing. None of this is about bringing down Microsoft or anything like that. This was about finding a community of people to get together and combine their efforts to create something that was greater than the sum of the parts, right? And greater than what any of us could have done individually. And so that's what I see as kind of the main connections. A final kind of thought is that I think this model is very important going forward because software is becoming so ingrained into our society, right? The average car that's made today, as I understand it, about 40% of the cost of making that car is in the electronics and is in the software. There's more software in you know, cars these days than there was, you know, total in the 1960s, right? In one car than there was computing power at all in the 1960s. It's pretty amazing. Software is coming to define our communication styles with each other, too. And looking ahead 20, 30 years, right, when you think about nanotech or you think about these things, the ability to control software and what it runs is very much related to your ability to interact in life. I hope that the software that gets written that is used to mediate all of our communications and mediate reality is software that's written by communities and software that embodies principles of transparency and collaboration. You know, I think that's kind of where this stuff could be headed and why I hope there's more communities like this doing things like this in the future. So that's it.
Does anyone have any one or two quick questions they want to ask now before we go on, or we can wait till afterwards as well? But anyone have any itching desire to ask a couple questions? Okay, we'll go on to Cliff.
Hi, my name's Cliff Skolnick, and I'm involved in a group called freenetworks.org. And we're just a group of people who are interested in providing infrastructure to let people get on the internet or on local nets and talk to each other without, you know, big company involvement and stuff like that. I've been involved in open source and various free nets, actually open source before it was called open source. It's in the mid-80s. Perhaps I've served up a grilled cheese sandwich to one of you guys at Burning Man or a party in the area. What's interesting about freenetworks.org is the roots of it were from community wireless groups such as the Bay Area Wireless Groups, which is, you know, based in the area here. You know, it's about 2,000 people on the mailing list. And the Bay Area Wireless Users Group was actually developed out of PlyaNet at Burning Man. The people who formed PlyaNet were getting so many questions, Matt Peterson and Tristan, that they decided to say, hey, let's all have a meeting in the Bay Area. And so we got a space at Critical Path and had our first meeting, and it grew from there. And from the, you know, mostly people interested in Burning Man, we now are about one-third venture capitalists, one-third engineering people, and about one-third users. So we have a pretty diverse community in that group. As that started growing, we also noticed other groups in Seattle, New York City, Vancouver, out in London, the Consume Group, Red Libre in Spain, also a lot of active groups in Brazil, Australia, the Netherlands, Sweden. So we said, hey, let's form a mailing list with the key founders of all these groups so we can, you know, basically have the core idea to share our knowledge. You know, we've all made the same mistakes, we realized. Like, oh, well, we can avoid that. We can all learn from each other. We also would have the ability as a group to solve some problems that were too difficult for one group to solve. And so the mailing list has been, you know, I can't even, you know, put a value on how that has brought us together and allowed us to really move things forward. But, you know, we still don't have a leader. We're, you know, very distributed. Whenever we need somebody to lead a project, we're having a, you know, a conference in Las Vegas this summer. We said, okay, who wants to lead it? You know, person raise their hand. Okay, you are now the leader. you know, we don't impose any structure. There's no membership requirements or anything like that. You know, if you want to be a member, guess what? You're a member. We have the same problems as like almost any group of volunteers. I think it's been said over and over. You know, how much time various contributors have. You know, how much follow through that those contributors, you know, can't execute on the various things that they say that they're going to do. We've also had some interesting issues with the press. We've attracted a lot of attention. Like, oh, these guys want to wire the world for free and put everybody out of business. And, you know, people have called us anarchist criminal parasites. Yes. Well, so our solution to that is the next conference that we went to, which was the O'Reilly Emerging Technologies Conference, we all had T-shirts made. And we wore them around saying, anarchist criminal parasite. So we got even more people talking to us. It was kind of great. And, you know, kind of what we said is we said, anarchists, well, yeah, but not like in the kind of the destroy anarchist, kind of in the cooperative, you know, type of way. You know, we want to build something that we can all share, feel that we have ownership in and be a part of, and at the same time not be beholden to some big company saying, well, you can't do that. You know, that's not part of our acceptable use policy. You can't share video over our network. It's too expensive. We want to build something that everybody can do. And the Consume Group in London is a great example of that. They didn't form their group to provide free internet connectivity. It was a bunch of guys with an itch. They had all this multimedia. There were some, you know, some fantastic videos and stuff like that that they wanted to distribute that they were unable to because there wasn't an infrastructure that would allow them to do that. So they said, okay, we're going to make our own. Criminals, well, you know, I don't like being called a criminal. I don't think anyone does. For every person that, you know, if you have a cable modem and you want to share that connectivity, your policy says, well, don't share that connectivity. But there are enough internet providers that will work with you and don't have a problem with you sharing that connectivity. So we encourage, you know, people to work with those providers. So, you know, make yourself not a criminal. And parasites, well, we don't even, you know, It's like a lot of us have our livelihood in the internet industry or technology. You know, we don't want to put an end to every ISP. We just want to, you know, have our own network that we can do what we want with. So, you know, we're not, I think we're providing more than we're taking from the industry. And in fact, most of our members, technology that we've developed as part of freenetworks.org is being used in commercial ventures like cafe hotspot providers and stuff like that. So, you know, we have a good relationship. You know, we call ourselves freenetworks.org. It probably would be better to call ourselves opennetworks.org because free, you know, I always say it's free as in free beer. You know, it doesn't really mean no cost. It might mean no money, but, you know, you're kind of going to have to trade off some of your own labor or some of your time or, you know, for that service that you're getting from the network. And hopefully it's worth it. But we are free because we don't have to answer to, like, an AUP saying, you know, you can't transmit MP3s over this network or video. You know, you can transmit whatever the network will take. And what we did is we actually, freenetworks.org, a bunch of us are actually, you know, Apache Software Foundation members. So what we did is we actually took some of that structure. We're heading towards getting our nonprofit status. Our model is to basically provide a support infrastructure for other groups, very, you know, that can act locally, or individuals. You know, we have a couple people that we've helped that have gone off to areas like Laos and the Dominican Republic to help some community networks there. And we're also pretty, we try to be sensitive to, you know, trying to replicate this pattern. Like, we get people coming propose us that, you know, I want to wire this, you know, backwater community. You know, we ask them questions like, you know, do these people have food and shelter and, like, water before? And there's a great story of one of the person in Seattle Wireless is down in South America putting fireplaces. Apparently a lot of people die because houses don't have fireplaces, so when they're cooking inside on fires or fires for heat, that, you know, the place will burn down or, you know, smoke inhalation. So, you know, his contribution rather than wireless is building fireplaces. And then lastly, one thing that we've noticed, and I'm sure other groups here are going to hit that, is splintering. Where a couple of our groups have kind of, you know, well, we're not seeing things like you're seeing. You know, what do you do in those type of situations? And we try to just say, okay, you know, shake the hands and, you know, good luck, guys. There's a group called the Wireless Commons, which was a bunch of former freenetworks.org people, and also with another group called the Shmoo Group, which, you know, it's a kind of a worldwide community hacking group, but hacking in the good sense. And so they're off doing their own thing, we're doing our own thing, and, you know, the way we look at it is the more people out there doing good things, the better. There's, you know, it doesn't make any sense to get in any type of confrontational relationship with anybody that's doing the same thing. So.
Thank you. Does anyone have any questions after that? Everyone asleep after lunch?
I wanted to comment a bit on the splintering thing, which is, so one of the, the definition, really, for what open source software is not just that you get the source code, but you get this essential, important, kind of cool thing called the right to fork, okay? And what that means is that if you have this software and it's, you know, you've got the source code to it and you want to modify it and you want to give somebody else those modifications, that modified version, you're allowed to do that. You don't have to go seek somebody's permission to do that. You might have some rules you have to live within, but you don't have to worry about, you know, getting some company to sign off on it. And what that means is that when you have a community that's working together to build software, if you have a technical debate or even a personality kind of debate that just seems irresolvable, those teams can decide to split off, or that one person, or the, you know, that small group, or whatever. They can decide to fork. Okay, this sets up kind of a Darwinistic, you know, competition for resources amongst different species, right? Where if there are two different web servers out there. They compete for customers, or, you know, customers, so to speak. They don't pay money. What that you compete for, though, is developer attention, developer resources. People who are signing up and saying, I'll fix bugs, I'll enhance it. And eventually one of them might die, or eventually they might come back together and merge or something like that. But what's important is that it acts like a safety valve for everyone, right? If there's a debate, if there's a discussion, then go off and work on it yourself and then come back together and compare the results. I think in the electronic dance community, we actually have a pretty healthy notion that you don't have to belong to just one collective, right? It's not about sitting in one camp and looking at some other camp. There are as many collectives, it seems sometimes, as many collectives as there are individuals with all these kind of overlapping spheres and stuff. And that's good, and that's healthy. It allows for, you know, people to differentiate and explore different ideas and groups to explore ideas without feeling like somebody has to make a choice. And so I think splintering is actually kind of healthy for maintaining, like, you know, lots of communities, or not so much maintaining as but allowing them to stay creative. Something like that. There's a question over there. Okay, so a couple things about what makes it different these days than maybe at least 1996 or even 2000. So there was a point where I was worried that, hey, with the collapse of the dot-com thing and you know, everything falling apart, that it would mean that there wouldn't be as many people working to write software and give it away for free. What it's meant, though, what that economy has meant, though, is that there are as many other companies who are being very kind of frugal about the money they spend and would much rather investigate using something that was free but didn't quite, you know, meet the requirements versus spending lots of money for something that met the requirements exactly. So I've actually seen open source software be just as active, people working just as proactive, you know, as actively on it as at any other time. So that health has remained solid. Secondly, the only real enemy out there, the only company that stood itself up to say that model is bad, right, has been Microsoft. Every other company, Sun, HP, even companies like GM and Ford and other companies that I could point to who are not IT companies have started to stand up and say, like, this Linux thing, it works. This Apache thing, it works for us. You know, why would we be spending so much money? We'll spend the money on consultants to piece it together and make it work, but forget about these high licensing fees. So the only company that's done that has been Microsoft. They've stood up to say, well, what are the economics around this kind of model, this kind of world? How do companies make money? How do people make money? As if they have the only model on how to do it. It's a different world, but there's still ways to make money, building on top of open source software or being an expert with it, a consultant with it. So, you know, success is the sweetest form of revenge, I guess, so I don't really worry too much about competitors so much as I worry about how do we keep this thing sustainable, you know, for the same reason why electronic dance communities think about sustainability and how do we keep what's important to us kind of ongoing.
Chris?
Well, if you're from the Bay Area, they would invite you to the Bay Area Wireless Users Group. I actually did a talk a few months ago on, you know, security for open access points. So, I believe my presentation is online. I can get that information to you after.
Okay. Back here first.
So I didn't get into it, but I started a company in 99 after I left Organic that focused on building open source communities, whether they are public ones or private ones within a company. And it's about both software as well as like community building. In fact, Uli used to work with us, and he was great along those lines. We sent him to Germany to teach about 200 German engineers who wrote this great Microsoft Office competitive package, teach them about how to share code and how to communicate with each other. And they were expected to do it with the public. They could barely do it with each other. So it was really tough work. And Uli and a bunch of us worked on helping make that happen. Extending it further, I guess, I've tried to think a lot about, because largely I'm interested in validating what we spend our times doing by seeing if there's some broader purpose or larger goal or larger ramification for it. And I see companies start to realize the value of consensus-driven kind of decision-making. I see them start to value the sense of transparency. I mean, you can look at a whole bookshelf full of business, theory books these days, and they're all about some of those concepts, right? It's conceivable to me that it's just with the rise of the ease of email and ease of communication tools and things like that, the ability to garner consensus becomes easier. The ability to have the output of some creative process consist of lots of individual inputs, right? Not just one person's vision, but a collective vision. I think that's happening. I think that's broader than even software development. And does the electronic dance community, have they played a role in that? Well, how many of the generation that's, between the ages of, 18 or whatever and 35 or 40 in the United States have been to a rave? It's probably pretty large. It's probably fairly substantial. Maybe a half of those probably actually grokked it, understood that it was about, people bringing things to share and having fun. And so I do have a hope that maybe, people have internalized that and taken it back to the office or taken it to the home or something like that and learn something from it. But I can't say for sure. I can't point to a number or a statistic or a metric that says that's happened. It feels that way, kind of. I don't know if I answered the question.
I have an interesting sort of insight, too, as well. And from a different point of view, I think that, at least me personally, I used to be adamantly against anything to do with money related to raves that Cloud Factory was throwing. But as I sort of matured and grew a bit older, I sort of looked at it as the artist model, where you're a band and you want to play your music and you want to make a living, you want to eat food. Actually, Dave just left, but Radiant Atmospheres is sort of a lighting company that spawned out of Cloud Factory, and there are people who said, basically, we want to make a living doing lighting. We like lighting. We love to share with people and get people excited about light. They did the lights in here. So they made that decision to become economically viable as a company outside of this, and it's been interesting to see this sort of change in getting people to support that and realize that they're not out there. Their goal is not to make a big profit. Their goal is to do something they enjoy doing. So it's interesting to come from a very idealistic community and bridge that gap and make people realize that being a company or someone that's just trying to make a living isn't inherently evil per se. It's hard to get over that sometimes, but.
There was a quote somebody said once on SF Raves, and somebody here might remember, maybe it was even Larry Ching, but I'm not sure. To rave is to affirm, right? One of the things that I've liked about that scene is the whole DIY ethic. It's definitely inherited from the punk scene, right? And I think the more that we can do to help society be less about, some small group of producers and a larger group of consumers, right, and be more about, encouraging people to not just be satisfied with their lot in life, but to go out and seize the bull by the horns and do something with it. The more that it can be about decentralizing power, decentralizing access to technologies that allow you to be creative and expressive and communicate with each other, the more good we'll do, I think. And if that is a role that the dance community can play in helping people realize that as they're going through life, then that's tremendous. That could be tremendous.
In the middle, back.
Okay.
Specifically, how you have, if you had a structure,
right.
Did a proposal get put out, get some engagement?
Actually, yeah. So given that this is hard to generalize because software is unique in that you can write something and objectively measure the quality, usually objectively measure the quality of that work, whether it's faster than some other alternative or something. Whereas most of the debates that I see on, you know, the different planners lists are about, you know, just very ephemeral or very aesthetic kinds of things. So given that, in Apache, right, we developed this process where, you have a group of people who could all change the code, and it's kind of, you keep a history of the changes and stuff, so it's very easy to kind of audit, right? If it's this obvious bug fix, you know, a typo or something like that, people could just go in and do it, right? And there's a way to review those changes so that you can, you know, keep tabs on each other. If it was about something that changed the behavior of the software, generally somebody would propose it in the form of a patch. They'd post that to the list. Other people would try it out. You'd have to get 3 thumbs up, basically, or plus ones, as we called it, and no vetoes. Okay, and basically you didn't have necessarily a time window, but it was generally within a week or two, right? And so that was a kind of low quorum, but it was made sure that, you know, if there really was a contentious kind of decision around this, then, you know, that one person's veto, you know, they'd have to say what would cause them to rescind their veto, what would be the issue that they'd address, and usually we could work it out from that. So it was simple, it was effective. I hesitate to say that's generally a way to make decisions, you know, but it does mean that those who are motivated are the ones, you know, to see that problem solved are the ones who are involved in the decision making, the most closest to the decision making. So there's probably other processes like that other groups could adhere to. Sometimes you just have a broad difference of opinion that comes down to aesthetics, and there's not really an easy way I can think of to address that.
Yeah. And at freenetworks.org, we actually use the same process. Like I said, thank you. We use it for not just for code. We actually use it for political decisions. It seems to work quite well. So we're sticking to it for now, and we'll modify if it needs to be. Any person can make a proposal. A few people have to agree with it. And anyone can veto it, but the veto has to have a reason. And then other people will kind of look at that veto, and you can kind of like veto the veto.
And a reason that can be addressed. You know, it's got to be like, oh, this patch sucks because it's got these 3 bugs.
Yes.
Or it does, we're putting too much, you know, into this product, and we should make an API, and so you can put your other functionality over there, or something like that.
But usually vetoes, one thing that I've noticed, a lot of interesting discussion follows from a veto. When someone, because you're sticking your neck out when you're saying no.
And as for the rave style communities, I know friends and family used to, I don't know if we stick this anymore, friends and family used to do online discussion, but no decisions were made until a face-to-face meeting. Cloud Factory doesn't really work that way because we're such a diverse group geographically. It's spread over all over the Bay Area, down to Monterey, Santa Cruz, so it's much, we actually haven't really had a face-to-face meeting for years, really, but that we don't really have it defined. It's more of like what we call the benevolent dictator model, where whoever's leading the discussion sort of decides when enough discussion has been done, just go ahead and make the decision if you're not going to offend anyone greatly. So, back in the back corner, you had a question. I'm actually happy to just have a conversation. I didn't really have anything planned. I was just going to talk about why I'm interested in this subject, and I was sort of the one who instigated this panel, so if you want, I can talk about it for a couple minutes after your question.
I think it comes down to what is the pool of people who have the shared interest, right? What is the size? And to some degree, it's about kind of the natural size of how many people can carry on a conversation at once. But I'd say it has more to do with how united are the ideals behind something. Like, you know, on the Apache side, when it was clear that there were a bunch of people who wanted to build what's called a servlet engine for Java, right? Very different than what a web server does, an HTTP server does. Related, they have to talk to each other. But but very different skill sets. I mean, one's in C code, one's in Java code, even as simple as that. We gave them a space over here. And we said, you know, there are a bunch of people who are coming into the community. We kind of assigned some people to work with them, to kind of incubate them, right, to share informally some of the tools that we had. We didn't, and still haven't really, written down kind of like the book about the Apache way, although that gets discussed a lot. But it was about give them a space, give them a structure, give them access to the same tools that you use, right, so that they can train up. I mean, there's a lot of discussion about mentoring and things like that. I think there was not so much officially that as unofficially. People from one side were interested in the other, so they'd hang out and watch. But I think there is kind of a natural limit to the number of people who can actively be trying to solve a problem together at once and just keeping up with it on a day-to-day basis and having assignments. And so, you know, something like the FNF campout, it wouldn't work unless you really tried to spread out a lot of these responsibilities, not just in terms of workload on any one individual, but the team doing food needs a space to talk about how to do the food that can be, you probably be more or less separable from the team that needs to talk about how to select the DJs, right? It's not about setting up walls so much as giving them their spaces and allowing for bleed and for migration and stuff like that. But the replication makes it sound much more formal than it actually was. I mean, it was more like, oh, wow, here's a whole new group of people, you know, who want something, go create a mailing list for them. You know, it was very ad hoc, but that kind of ad hoc organic kind of thing, just respond to the people and what they say that they need, you know, is probably the best way to go about it. I don't know if I answered your question really, but, okay.
So just briefly, I'll get you in one second. What is it? It's 2003, so the first time I ever used email was 10 years ago. In that time, I found the electronic dance community. I changed my college major from architecture to computer science and then proceeded to drop out and start an internet service provider, which was the fancy thing of the time. Went on to be a Unix admin and worked at Topica, which was where I was director of operations for a bit, and so managed to work with a service that was doing free mailing lists. And within 10 years of not even having ever owned a computer really before 1993, was working at a company sending out 50 million email messages a day. So my interest in this whole topic is very sort of ingrained in how I've grown up in the last 10 years and used both of these communities to sort of fulfill a lot of things I was looking for in my life. So that's why I wanted to bring this together. And Brian may not even know this little story, but part of why I got so interested in web development early on and internet-related stuff was Brian linked the Cloud Factory webpage off of the Hyperial homepage when I was in college. It was the first time I'd ever done a web page and was just sort of playing around with it. And of course, being linked there got like 1,000 hits in the first couple weeks, and we were just like, whoa, so cool. So, it got a lot of feedback and sort of led to me getting a lot more interested in computers, and it was sort of just a good opportunity. And so that's why I wanted to bring this together. And I have, in the future, I'm unemployed right now, but in the future, I have some ideas about possibly doing projects that are related to studying more about how these communities are using different tools, like online forums, online mailing lists, news groups, instant messaging, and working on building even just plain email without a list, just email on one-to-one, and how to make some sort of service that nonprofits who don't have people skilled in this can easily pick and choose what works for them and build some sort of essentially a custom communications infrastructure for them that they can just come to a website and say, I want an email list that feeds into a forum, and then I want to be able to instant message with my group. How do I do that? And not have to be a rocket scientist to figure that out. So that's in the future. If you're interested in that, let me know, because I'm thinking about doing that in the next couple of years.
I'd like to ask if in an anarchistic structure, as a leader, head, no official spokespeople, how do you deal with the issue of who speaks for the group? And I don't mean in some abstract way, I mean in very specific ways. We've all been in these things, and I'd like you to focus your answer totally with the dance communities, because you always have that situation where somebody promises something to the group, somebody commits the group to something, some small group.
Well, I mean, at Free Networks, we've dealt with that just by hopefully we have enough respect for each other that we're not going to commit somebody to something without asking. We kind of even though we don't have a leader, we kind of do take an informal thing. Okay, who wants to take press, field press calls and stuff like that? And so I think, you know, I guess it's similar to like, you know, a site coordinator where you probably want to have one person that has a pretty high level of trust in the group. And the group has to have a high level of trust in him to kind of take that role. And, you know, it rotates. It's never just one person doing that work. It's usually one or two people, and, you know, and it changes over time.
I think every community, even ones that think they're anarchistic, have leaders who essentially emerge. I think so long as those leaders realize that their recognition as a leader is not an entitlement nor something they own, but something where the credibility comes entirely from the trust put in them by everyone else. If they're humbled enough to realize that that's the case, then when they go out and if they speak to somebody about what's going on, they're not going to say, oh, yeah, we'll sign up for that. You know, they're going to say, we can't sign up to anything. Come back with a proposal. We'll think about it and come to you or something like that, right? And so insofar as I have, you know, spoken on behalf of the ASF for a while and had some bit of formal recognition, I was president of it for whatever that was worth, right? But I was always clear to make sure that you know, the only things I was saying was the things that I had heard were kind of the consensus of the community at that time about what we thought we were doing, and certainly wasn't signing a deal with any company to sign us up to anything. Now, we had a certain luxury around that. You know, we weren't paying anyone's salary, so it was never a life or death decision, right? Which not every company can, or not every group of people who get together have that luxury, I guess. But no, I think you just have to be careful about, or leaders have to be careful about understanding where their source of credibility comes from.
And in the sense of Cloud Factory, I think if I think about it a little bit, it's sort of an imposed group responsibility, where there's two different types of sort of public interaction, which is at an event, where if you're in the position of being at the door, being site coordinator, you've been given that responsibility by the group to be that sort of public face. And then outside of that, I think there's also just sort of an imposed group responsibility that if you misuse that, in essence, privilege to speak for the group, or I don't know if speaking for the group is the right word, but if you use misuse that privilege of talking about the group or misrepresenting what other people may be thinking, then in essence you'll be, there's the fear of being ostracized or people saying, no, that's not right, that's, you can't speak like that for the group. So I think that, I don't know if we've just been lucky, but we've never really had a problem with people going outside of the group and being like, saying things that weren't really true or that the group didn't think. And saying things like what the group thought is sort of difficult in a group with 150 people. You can't ever really say what the group thinks. But I understand what your question is, because sometimes you do have to say it in words, which is much different than actions, as Theo was saying. Let's see, right here.
One to one.
Where, at a party, at an office? What? I don't know.
Does it matter?
No.
In this room?
Okay, back in the back corner.
A question about the ASF and podcast, both networking don't you start?
So I'll start. It's somewhat interesting because we didn't actually discuss. I don't know if there was a hesitancy in my part, but I didn't spend a lot of time trying to encourage discussion among the 150 people on our sort of general discussion list when we were doing it. It was always a goal from early on when we started as seven people to eventually formalize the group and start to do other things that helped other communities and other people. An interesting thing that's a result of essentially reorganizing as a nonprofit group some of the people and starting what's sort of the other half of the brain maybe or you know, on a parallel track, is that as a nonprofit corporation, we have a board of directors, and so we've actually started meeting face-to-face again, and there's a small, it's in almost in a way been returning to sort of roots and rethinking about how we do things and starting some discussions again that had sort of waned in the growth period. So I think it's been beneficial to reorganize in that we're thinking a lot more about what we're doing and not just sort of riding the roller coaster down the free fall.
The Apache Software Foundation got started in 1998 when that was kind of a watershed year for a lot of open source projects. It's when Mozilla was released. It's when, you know, companies started to wake up and realize they were using it and they better recognize it as something official. It was the year that IBM kind of said, well, we've got our own little web server over here. We've got 100 engineers working on and it's got 0.323% market share or something like that. And we'd rather work on Apache. So partly it was because there's a lot of corporate interest now. Partly, but also largely because we realized that with so many people using it, and the copyright on it said copyright the Apache group, there was no legal Apache group, right? If someone ever decided to challenge it, a lawsuit would name Cliff Skolnick and Brian Behlendorf and you know, the other individuals who were contributing to it, and that it was so vague that we couldn't really protect ourselves. If somebody said, hey, you've got copyrighted code or patent infringing code in there, and we want $10 per downloaded copy of Apache, right? It would kind of suck. So that was the main reason we started the nonprofit. And the nonprofit was set up as a membership-based organization. So, you know, we'd already kind of had a stratification where there's people who had commit privileges and then others who were just on the list feeding in and out. So there was already that kind of differentiation. We created a new one that was called being a member of the ASSF, which was by invitation. And that's when somebody had really kind of clearly contributed a lot and were serious about it. We started with maybe 30 or so ASF members, and there's now 80. And then they elect a board, and the board kind of, you know, delegates everything because the board meets and it's all volunteer or whatever. So even though we again, set up these structures, it was about having accountability and having representation. And our board meetings are open to ASF members. I mean, we try to have that element of transparency there to address those concerns about trust and about, you know, a group of people who are leading the organization. But I'd say it wasn't really any question that we should do it, right? Everyone kind of bought into the idea that we should, if only to protect the people who were contributing into the server, into the project. The real question was about structure, but really once we said we'll do everything or almost everything with a high degree of transparency, that whole question about trust largely boiled down to, well, okay, we'll go about it and see what happens, right? So that's worked pretty well. I mean, certainly there are debates in the community, certainly there are wild divergences of opinions and very public flameouts and things like that, and people do get burned out. I mean, we're still all volunteer. We've never paid a dime for anyone's time, right, except for lawyers. That sucked. Other than that, it's all still been volunteers, so finding that balance has been interesting.
Okay, we're out of time, but how quick is your question, Billy? Okay.
I'll be around.
Really quick one from Christine.
We were pretty lucky in that companies who were starting to use it started wondering where they could write checks to, you know, because so it could appear as a line item on their budget to make it real somehow. So we said that was another reason to start the ASF, was to give people a place where they could make donations to if they wanted. So we've never gone out and actively solicited money, but we've got enough money kind of packed away that in case we ever had like a serious kind of patent lawsuit or something like that, we'd be able to defend ourselves. But no, I mean, we when we started, we went around to some companies and said, hey, we're kind of pooling some resources, and we said, here's, you know, a bunch of money. So it was kind of too easy. If we ever had to do it, it'd be work, but we'd do it.
1998 was a great year.
Oh, I know.
Okay, well, we're out of time on this session, so we're going to head on into the next one. But thanks, Brian. Thanks, Cliff.